Thanks for joining, everyone. So actually, this is season two of DevRev. So season one was earlier this year. It was 11 episodes, if I remember correctly. And that was basically the first part of DevRev. And now we're resuming DevRev for another season. Yes, amen. The last season background was definitely different. I actually changed apartments, so this is not even the same apartment as last season. But yeah, so this is season two. This is the first episode, of course. With us today, the awesome Usama Zeki, who's actually coming live from Sweden. I will talk about that. Thank you very much, Usama, for joining today. This is episode one. We're going to be talking today about the role of director of engineering. I'm actually really curious about that and kind of getting to know a little bit more sort of Zeki's experience and sort of his day-to-day and so on. So we're going to be talking about the role. We're going to be talking about the skills required. We're going to be talking about what it takes to get there and why would you be interested in becoming director of engineering. And we're going to be also talking about all of this from the perspective of Zeki, of course. He's a director of engineering at Svea Solar. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
It's correct.
Cool. They are actually the fastest growing tech company in Sweden. And they are, in a nutshell, I think probably he would do a better job of sort of introducing that. But I'll just kind of mention that they're the leading clean tech company in Europe in general. And they do smart and green home electricity. They do home Internet of Things, car chargers in Sweden, Spain, Belgium, Netherlands, and also Germany. So basically, an even cooler version of Tesla and SolarCity. Is that an accurate description?
That's very modest to take it, but yeah, something around that.
All right. So let me ask you this. So what is Svea Solar? What do you guys do?
Well, I would describe, I mean, it's a bad thing to describe it by our competitor, but I would say yes. So we're competing against Tesla when it comes to renewable energy, and not only renewable energy in terms of products, but also in terms of technology behind it. We're competing with companies like, you know, big electricity dinosaurs. I don't know, Morocco, for example, France community, like EDF, and like there is a German one, E.ON. And those are like big electricity players in the world. And what we're trying to do is kind of, you know, pull the rug under their foot, because they're doing it in old school.
Right.
Think about it like that. It's the same fight that you'd see with fintech. There is the old school banks and there is the uprising banks like N26, Revolut, Klarna, and all this kind of stuff, Stripe. And that's the same thing. We're leading the same fight in terms of electricity and energy. We're kind of trying to build a better future with technology, basically. And we're approaching it's a really nice market, since you work with something that you consume day to day. I mean, if it's not for electricity, we wouldn't have life, right? And stuff like that. And also the shift, like even transport is shifting to electric with the rise of electric cars. So we gotta prepare some really nice technology for a better future. And that's what we are working on, basically.
Nice. Sounds very exciting for sure. And you've been there how much now?
1 year, exactly 1 year.
Nice.
And it's been an amazing journey. Felt like it's 12 years. It's moving super fast. Like now as we speak, there's probably something was already pushed to production, and now we're thinking about the next thing. So it's a fast moving business, I would say.
Nice. Yeah, I forget to mention that you're the director of engineering at Svea Solar, and you're also a competitive skydiver, right?
Yeah, that's another topic for another day.
Definitely,
I mean, crazy things. One of them is skydiving, and I've been doing it under the Swedish Federation for now. It's been
nice.
Fun.
Cool. So to go back to kind of director of engineering role, I'm kind of curious, if did you join as a director of engineering, or you know, you joined, you know, as another in another role and you got promoted?
I joined directly as a director of engineering. That was the description. So during the interview process, it was for the director position.
All right. And is it something that you typically apply for, or is it like you get approached in a way, right? Or is it sort of a little bit like normal roles where you can also like go on a job board, apply and all of that?
So it's actually a fun story. And when I tell it, it sounds like a dream, but it is what it is. So in Sweden, that is what we call the recruiter's dilemma.
Okay.
So you always get approached by open your LinkedIn. We don't use LinkedIn these days because they just spam from recruiters.
Right.
They try to recruit you to this company. And because there is like the market is pretty stiff when it comes to tech. There isn't much engineer in the whole Sweden, I would say Stockholm. And then, but the demand is so high. It's like the tech companies are just booming. And you name it, like starting from Tesla, Google, Microsoft, Klarna, like all the companies, tech giants, they have their Nordic hub. But then there isn't that much talent that gets produced from the universities. Most of the people are like, there's a lot of, like I would say, Ukraine, Russia, Poland engineers, there's French engineers, Americans as well, working in Stockholm. And that created a market really good for recruiters. So they basically, they hunt for people. They know there's just like, there isn't much. And basically you could just go in and manage some engineers. So you get a recruiter that speaks with you and you manage your portfolio somehow, like a football player or something like that.
yeah, like an agent.
So I had the friend of, I call him a friend of mine. I would call him a manager. Sounds like a rapper or like a soccer player. Friend of mine, his name is Peter. He's based in UK actually. And so what he does is like, he calls you, he kind of gets to know you and he gets to know your background. What is it that you're good with? Say you're a Java person or like you're a really solid front-ender. So he gets to know your profile. And on the side, he kind of speaks with companies and he tries to find you the best, you know, position. And he keeps an eye on what company might be good for you and stuff like that. And and he kind of linked me up with Svea. He was like, there is this company, the Uprising Startups. They work with energy, sustainability, and they need a director. And I mean, your skills could match and stuff like that. I thought it was interesting. So I met one of the co-founders, Nolan, and we had a great conversation. And he basically sold the idea to me. He was like, this is
nice.
Up. And I was like, yep, sounds good. Let's go.
Nice. That's really cool. And okay, so you joined directly as a director of engineering. You were actually sort of, in a way, headhunted, as much as I don't like that word very much. But okay, so what it's like to be sort of, first of all, is that a role that you previously did, or it's kind of your first time as sort of a director of engineering?
So in my previous job, I kind of had a free role, like a, you know, like a midfield person. You know, you start as an engineer, but then you become everything.
Yeah.
You kind of start teaching people, you kind of start touching different projects and without being officialized as a manager or something. I think in the tech scene, we call it an individual contributor. So you're not really interested in managing projects and people, but you're kind of influencing a lot of decisions, and it's more of like an architect sort of setup. So that was it for me. I never was tempted by actually managing agendas and things like that, managing people, different projects and streams and kind of political. It gets very political.
Of course.
But this was my first job and I was like, well, let's try it out. I think it's for a good cause. At least we're saving the planet. We're not creating fintech or working on some gaming. Feels good at least. If I'm spend my energy and like at least stress out, better do it for something like would benefit, you know, our future generations.
100%. Yeah. So let's get to kind of the role itself and the responsibility. So what is the typical day-to-day in sort of your life? Like what's your, like, are you writing code? Are you managing people all the time? Are you managing sort of projects? What's the deal?
It's just meetings all the way, man. I'm not joking. Well, it's pretty diverse, I would say. That's what I love about it. There is no sense of monotony in it. You know, there's a whole package of novelty. You know, a typical day would be probably starting the morning with a partner meeting where you speak high level architecture. It gets pretty tense. It gets very deep tech stuff like OL stuff, and you have to consider a lot of things. Then you could follow up with some team syncs. So you have like different teams and you have to sync up with them, do some review sessions, make sure that we're basically aligned. Sometimes I do have some mob sessions where I sit down with some individual contributors or like mostly senior people, and we sit down together and we kind of code on something. Those are my favorite. Kind of was one of the deal breaker. I was like, I get to code. That's it. You just can't stop me. So I still do code. I do a lot of interviews to kind of stuff up and kind of hand for nice talents and people that are willing to kind of contribute. We do a lot of stakeholder management, as in have meetings with PMs and kind of the product organization. So we kind of align on roadmaps and all this sort of stuff. So I would say it's very to a lot of things.
Nice. And how big is are you managing one team or are you kind of managing like multiple teams?
It's a multiple team structure. So I would say it's five teams.
Okay.
Working on different products. Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, I mean, from what I know, like, you know, director of engineering kind of fits, it's kind of like, a manager of multiple teams, and then you get to sort of, or a manager of managers actually, right? So it's like, do you have engineering managers below, or is it kind of like managing teams directly?
It depends on the company structure, to be completely honest.
Right.
In the tech business, all the tech companies, and when I say tech companies, is that companies that are their products is technology. And like, for example, I wouldn't say car companies are tech companies. Like I would say Google, Amazon,
right.
Even banks that are like, they are fintech, like for example, Revolut and N26, those are also tech companies. Like Netflix, it is a streaming company, but somehow it's a tech company because they kind of,
yeah, there's a whole debate like about WeWork, Netflix, like, are they like, you know, streaming companies, real estate company or tech company?
Yeah.
Like, Where do you draw the line?
Yeah. So for me, I would say drawing the line on based on how they use technology.
Right.
There's companies that technology for them is just an enabler, but some companies technology is part of the product. Like for example, Netflix wouldn't exist if they didn't have their streaming servers. So they have a really nice engineering task force that kind of enabled the product. So you qualify as a tech company. Like for example, Uber, it's not a taxi company. They built a whole infrastructure to do autonomous kind of transport and logistics system. So, you know, their core product is built on technology. So, and going back to the tech company and the structure that you find in such organizations, it varies like quite a lot. There are some companies where they have a CTO leading the whole kind of technology side of the company. And that's mostly companies that are in servicing like AWS, Google, where you're basically pure tech. In some companies, you don't find a role of a CTO, but you find a VP of engineering. It's like vice president of engineering, and it's that person kind of reports directly to the CEO. But there is no like technology is not a part of the executive decision.
Right. The C-level, yeah.
Exactly. So there is that, but there is companies where you're not really enterprise level, so you're still like neither a startup, you're like a scale-up. So you basically had your fence right, you started having revenue. Your product is out there, you're kind of scaling. Usually there, you don't find that level of hierarchy. You'd find, for example, in our company, we have a CTO and then there is director of engineering. And that makes it really flat. Like even the conversation is pretty, the CTO doesn't have other branches of the company.
It's right.
That side. And then within that one, you find under the director, you find engineering managers. And those are basically people that coded well, people that can code, people that were respected by their colleagues, They have that initiative, and they take on a position where they lead the team. So the kind of from within. So, and you work with the same people, basically. You have your stand up, you don't really have that a culture that is separate from other teams, but it's the same thing. It's just that you're focused on one product. And then right. You usually find an engineering manager there. We call it managing from within. So you're with the team. And then you find like different squads and teams. They have their engineering manager. Basically, some companies, they call it tech lead. Some companies, they call it competence lead. It depends. So the setup is different. But it usually for a director, it goes one level up. So instead of managing one project, you basically have 5 projects or even 20 or more. It depends. Some teams, they don't stick to one project. Some teams have 3 projects, for example. And you have more of like a strategic level. So you go on beyond and you go like a bird eye view, and you kind of see, well, you have to think of strategy, how the product should correlate together, make right. sure we're not repeating ourselves. If we're building one thing, we'd rather have a one platform to do achieve stuff. Think about it. If you think about like the Google model, like you wouldn't need one profile to log into YouTube and one profile to log into Gmail and one profile to log in other services. There is an aggregation layer, and that right. usually that kind of flow, you need to have like some another type of leadership to kind of streamline everything. So you kind of abstract, you know, you look at 5 teams and you see that they're doing something similar. So you want to abstract it a little bit and have it higher and standardized. Within the director scope, you'd also find culture. So kind of decisions like, how should we use GitHub or should we use Confluence or something like that?
Right.
AWS or Google Cloud, this kind of things. So you don't want to be too much in details to choose specific frameworks, but at least you choose the platform.
Right. And are the teams structured around products or sort of technical areas? Like, for example, I saw a team structured where like you have director of engineering backend, director of engineering front end, like they sort of would be involved with sort of these specific teams. Or is this kind of more structured around, I guess at Google probably it's around director of engineering search, director of engineering Gmail, all of these areas. What is it sort of the case in your SVA Solar?
There is that model. I mean, I've seen that model and I worked with it, where you have director of engineering front end, director of engineering back end or platform,
right?
Stuff like this. But it's just like it's proven that it's not working.
Right.
Friction. You build products that are weird.
Yeah.
Gap between a set of features that needs to be met by basically a platform or a back end, but then you overhead communication. So what you see nowadays in most of the tech companies is that you see squads that are cross-functional and it's product-based. So you have, for example, like a director of, for example, platform, and you make sure that you're building a platform with its portal and everything else. You have a director, as you said, of, you don't have a director of Gmail. You have like probably director of G Suite.
Right.
And then in that you have calendar, Gmail.
Yeah.
Gmeet and all this kind of stuff. So right. This is how you see it more often. And most of the companies, that's how they operate. Like, for example, the Spotify model is purely this. They have the search section when it's just like a whole organization. And for them, they don't really care about that Spotify client. They just make sure they do search end to end from basically the deep stuff algorithms into the infrastructure, into the API level, into the authorization identity stuff. And then they even go beyond and do some front-end SDKs. So kind of like the client would be just a plug and play. You find like monorepos in this kind of setups. So if you want to work, because you don't really want to kind of split the tech in a way, as I said before. So if you are using some sort of pipelines to deliver your code, you don't want that split too much into products, but you still want to like, it becomes a matrix actually. So you have monorepos, so basically you clone the whole shit. Then you know where you're going to be working. You're going to be touching a bit of backend, the front end. You're going to be doing some DevOps. But then you have your own pipelines. Just only deliver your stuff. Doesn't touch the others. So this kind of stuff. So, and in order to have this kind of setup, it takes a lot of technical background. You need some solid engineers that understand what they're doing, where they can think abstract enough, but also focused enough on their scope. So, but that's how it is. Like, especially at Sveya, we operate in this model basically. We try to do end to end without breaking and adding communication overhead.
Right. And what technologies are kind of you using throughout your products?
We are a JavaScript based company. Nice. We use TypeScript all over. So that's we still like some typed stuff. But all our backend stuff, we use, we have all our platform is cloud native. So we use Lambda functions.
Nice.
We don't do any like infrastructure. We do infrastructure as code. We use a lot of Terraform and stuff like that. We use API gateways. If we get to kind of expose any business logic that needs to be consumed somewhere, we use API gateways. We use a lot of, so that's what I'd call cloud native these days. Basically, you know, it's kind of fine line between, you know, container driven stuff and microservices and cloud native, because you distribute, but you completely distribute.
Right.
It can be scary, but with the right skills, it's really beautiful. You have granularity in terms of operations. If you nail down your traceability and observability, you'd get really something beautiful. And also, you can have heat maps of how your whole platform behave. You can see what is the critical things. And basically, you could check which function is called the most. And
right.
This is a business critical function, so you kind of give it extra. It helps you kind of organize things. We do have, and that's it. So that's based on TypeScript purely and Terraform. We do have microservices, like more of like high level APIs that are consumed directly by front end or partners and things like that. And those we use in Node.js. We have our own framework-ish. I mean, we use Express, but we built like a kind of Ruby on Rails style on top of event driven. And it's really beautiful. So we kind of took on REST and GraphQL, and we were like, REST is too much. We're not going to use get, post, patch, and put on all these options and stuff like that. We only need post. Right. And we looked at GraphQL, and it gives you that granularity of like actually querying the instead of following what REST tells you. And we combined those, and we made like a minimalistic GraphQL based on REST. It works beautifully. We're thinking about open source it, but we're letting it mature a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, you end up with a microservice that is functional, purely functional. So instead of calling REST or doing GraphQL query, you call a function. You say, get user, these are the arguments, and you get input, output. It's also beautiful to test. It helps with mock-driven development. So fast. Sometimes we find ourselves building a lot of mocks that we have to implement later on. So that helps us quite a lot. You could have endpoints with some business logic up quickly, like I'd say 1 hour, if you know what you're doing.
Nice. And what are you like building? Like, are you building sort of like on the front end, say mobile apps? Are you building, you know, web platforms? What's kind of the deal there?
So for front end, I haven't mentioned it, but we use React Native. So that closed the gap. So we have TypeScript all the way. But on front end, we use mainly React Native, React for our platform and some of our web tools. And what we're building is basically a lot of set of products. So what we're trying to do here is have one app that rules them all. So what you like, we have different products. We have solar installations. So for example, solar at home, you have a villa, you have like a roof, you could just lay down some solars and enjoy free money. We have electricity at home, basically LIDEC or whatever, Loeno, I don't know what you guys have in Morocco. But it's not, but forget about paper and pay in Mulhanout and stuff like that. It's basically, you see live what you're consuming. You go to the app, you go like, oh, yeah, I consume 20 euro. That's too much, cut up. You know, you kind of these things like that. And it gives you some live update on how your consumption behavior. If you have the solar panels, then you get even upgraded. You could see production against consumption. So you could see which part of electricity actually you are self-sustained. You didn't need to actually get electricity from the grid. Yeah. And which part, like, you kind of saved because some people have home batteries and the whole thing. So it kind of makes you aware of your energy consumption behavior and kind of make you, we have some smart ways of doing savings. So we tell you the equivalent of trees you saved. We have, if we see like a spike, we tell you probably you want to change your microwave or your coffee machine. It's probably still from the 60s and sucks.
That's really cool.
All this kind of stuff. We do have, and making it fun. You could compare, like if you live in a 2-bedroom apartment and you are 2 people, we're trying to have a pool of similar users. So we compare your consumption and we tell you, well, for an apartment like you, you shouldn't be consuming this much. Think about that. This kind of things. We have like a leaderboard gamification we're trying to accomplish here. And that's from the electricity part, but we also have the IoT part, for example, self-balanced home management. So now classic, what you find in classic homes these days, you have that meter, which is classic. Some of them are mechanic even. And there is like a whole board that is completely, it's not connected. So you're not really connected to the grid. We can't self-balance the grid and it costs a lot. Not for you, but actually for to kind of to maintain that infrastructure and kind of optimize it. It's basically impossible to optimize it. There is no way of knowing how much you'd consume in order for us to optimize. So that's a big challenge. So what we're trying, and that one we're trying to approach it from like having a smart home board. So basically electricity that you take from the grid connects to that board before it comes to your home. So you kind of have an adapter that speaks, like it's an Internet of Things protocols, like for you think about, we use data networking, sometimes we use Wi-Fi, but it depends. Sometimes there's different protocols in that. And what we try to achieve is basically we give you a chance to monitor what's going on. We can control stuff and see how much current you'd need and kind of distribute it properly within the residentials. We could actually predict how much electricity we would need. So we can produce right the amount because we're still struggling. Like if you look at the energy sector, a lot of energy is just thrown away because it's either overproduced or get expensive. Like if for European countries, sometimes they have to turn on the nuclear engine. So we kind of to feed up the stuff and it kind of costs a lot and all of that. And basically why they can't optimize is that they have no data. And that's what we're trying to do with IoT. You could actually collect data and aggregate.
And this data you're sharing it with sort of the companies that are producing electricity in this case?
So for now, that data is kind of your gold mine. You don't want to do that. So you don't really share that data with anybody. But what you want to do, you want to share insights and kind of make sense out of that data. Because usually data these days becoming so mainstream, but people just want to gather data. They don't know what to do with it.
Right.
It's only beneficial and only converts into value when you make sense out of it. And when I say make sense out of it is getting certainties about some things. Like that's how the whole advertisement, AdWords and all this kind of works. And what kind of uncertainty you want to remove is that how much are we going to need of electricity?
Right, because it kind of depends on the seasons. Exactly. On certain days, you might have these spikes, right? Because
just like that.
What happened that day.
People use lights and it's winter and people need to warm up at home and vacation, people watch TVs and all this kind of stuff. So you start to get tap into that type of behavior and understand. And then once you understand, you can build models that can say exactly what how many are we going to produce given the whole solar network. So you could see the weather, you could correlate with past years and you could tell, okay, next week, this is residential solar is going to produce this. And you could see how much we're going to consume per commune, per city and stuff like this. And you could have like that model. Then you start tapping into demand and supply. And that becomes very interesting for companies because energy in Europe is kind of like a currency. It goes up and down in real time. It's not like prices in Morocco. They're pretty set according to the US dollar. This is how much electricity costs in Morocco. In, for example, Sweden and all the Nordic countries, basically electricity goes up and down as currencies. If a lot of people need electricity, and we don't have that much, then the price is going to be expensive.
Okay.
Not that much electricity, but not much demand. Well, it could be cheap. So if you start getting into that, that's where the benefits come in. You know, you're optimizing the whole thing, but at the same time, you're driving prices and you could basically control the whole thing. From a nice way, sustainable.
Well, that explains why you guys are kind of, you know, one of the fastest growing companies in Sweden, also probably in Europe in the coming years. That's really cool. All right, so you're involved, I guess, across different products, and you have obviously in sort of the teams that you interact with, you have people with different backgrounds using different technologies, some front end, some back end, and all of that. Does it mean that as a director of engineering, you need to know to learn all of these technologies? Do you need to know React Native, do you need to know TypeScript, Express, all of that? Or you can get away with knowing some of those technologies and just kind of like, I would say, run through the rest?
It's a very, very, very nice question. Because I think if I get to name the top skills you need to become a director of engineering, I would probably put understanding details on technology probably number 7 or something, because that's not what you want to be doing.
Right.
You want to have that background in computer science. You understand how data flow. You understand what it means to write code, to deploy code, and to monitor and test code. You want to know how network works. You know, like, it's kind of one-on-ones. Like, if I have a server that needs to speak with this, how am I going to do that? You want to understand a little bit of, yeah, that computer science stuff. You know what a server is. You know what a client is.
Right.
You know, you can do curl in your terminal and do stuff. You know that kind of, and that's what you only need. Then that will give you the chance to understand technology, even if it's new for you. Like, I haven't done basically cloud native before, but I understood the concept, which is, so instead of having a server that is up all the time and waiting on some port, you basically start a function in a sandbox environment and you get the output. Oh, that's it. Okay. So then you adapt to it. So React Native, necessarily not. I mean, I had a front-end background. I did 2 years of doing front-end. I've done Angular, the first one, then Angular 2, then I've done React. I've done some Vue, but then I was very quick on not hooking up on the thing. You know, you just basically try it out. You understand the concept, then you move on. But then I've done backend. I started as a backender. That gave me a little bit of background on build. I've worked with Java EE, so you get to understand oriented and all that stuff. I'm not a big fan of it these days. Then I worked a bit on Scala, so you get that functional part. I've hanged out with a lot of Erlang people, so you kind of start understanding. And what you want to have is not expertise in a technology, because that can hurt you really bad if you're directing. And then you'd find yourself with one type of hammer. Any problem coming at you, you try to kind of bang it out. Sometimes you just have to smooth it out. Sometimes you're going to be like, wait, I've seen this pattern in this community. This would fit perfectly.
Right.
And you want to be that agnostic. You want to know what's going on, but at the same time, not try to make it happen. And I think it's tricky. If most of the tech leads, they fail to kind of get away from that and kind of not let it be, man. You're not an expert in iOS or whatever. But if you have skilled people that can bank that stuff and give you output and value, let them be. At least you understand how an artifact is and somehow iOS will run it.
Right.
Put it in App Store and that's it.
So you're not supposed to be the expert on each technology that you have, that you're using to, or the teams are using to build your products. You just need to know sort of the foundational stuff, right? Like, if it's a mobile app, you understand at least like how it's communicating with the APIs, how we're securing all of that. Like, what is going on a sort of bird's eye view level inside each mobile app, and kind of to make decisions or at least be involved in that decision making. So that's super clear. Actually, you mentioned something earlier, which is that this aspect of being an expert on technology, or at least having a deep understanding, is number 7 on what you would say the top skills. Then in that case, what is the top 3? Like, what would you say are the essential skills for becoming a director of engineering or being a good director of engineering?
I mean, it's a tough question for me, like 1 year of experience as a director, but I could share my experience. What are the things that really helped me kind of go on with the position, and what are the things that I'm still working on? So, and I would say number one, top skill, without like being a programmer or whatever, or like you have to talk, is analytical thinking and that sense of innovation. So I explain a concept to you, like now I was talking about energy, and I was talking about it from a real world thingy, but I know behind my mind, I see like systems, and I see like a box that speaks with this, and I see like a network of things. And that, you know, the analytical thinking makes you understand problems and situations. Like, right. And that makes a huge difference. Like, you could see that in engineers from all levels. Like, you could, no matter if you're a junior, senior, whatever your seniority is, some people, they just have the analytical thinking, you know, they get the idea. And it's not really programming. It's basically, if I teach you how tax works, you should have that light mind, you know, we say in Derija, aql khfif. You know, you make sense out of it. You could simply teach it to someone else.
Right.
And that innovation comes, and you know, and the more you get exposed to different like type of problems, like if you worked with fintech, then you worked with software servicing, then you worked with gaming, then you worked with, I don't know, streaming and stuff like that. It makes sense. It will be easy for you. You say a streaming platform. I see some WebRTC and like some multiplexer and, you know, image,
right.
And that's it, you know, and you start seeing, and that's skill number one. You have to do that because your day-to-day job is basically speaking with PMs that they don't get the technology. For them, they don't understand. Right. It's like they probably understand what an API is, what backend and frontend is, but if you tell them how internet works, they wouldn't answer you. They would be like, probably someone speaks some three computers or something. I actually asked a few friends. And I was surprised of the answer. So it gives you perspective. So if you have the analytical thinking, then you'd be able to translate whatever the business case, whatever the problem is in real life, to kind of actual design thinking and system architecture and all of that. And that's basically your job. The second thing I would say is probably active learning. You don't become a director. It's something you have to develop like basically every day. And I didn't say learning, I said active learning. Because pretty people that are enthusiastic about Rust and they were like, oh, Rust is cool, it has this, but they're not actively learning it, you know. They just know there is a cool memory and garbage collector, but they can't tell you how it works. Right. That's actually sad. You could see that in the tech community everywhere. Like people, they just know, well, yeah, TypeScript is typed JavaScript, but I would say 80% of the TypeScript community doesn't understand types.
Right. You
know, I've seen people writing TypeScript code and I'm like, what is this? Like, just go back and write JavaScript, man. You're just doing it wrong. Or like, you know, you gotta have the active learning.
And when you say active learning, like knowing like behind the scenes how it works, or is it knowing the why behind things, or like?
I mean, this is not specifically for technology, but like for everything. You have to be active learning. If you see like your struggles in meetings to keep the agenda clear, go learn about how to manage a meeting. If you think that you're really bad at setting up a backlog of tasks, bad at prioritizing or breaking down big tasks into smaller ones that are smoothly run through and you could parallelize and stuff like that, go learn. There is books, there is videos, and practice, not just listen to a podcast or stuff like that. That will not cut it, man. In tech, you have to be very active. Like, if you learn something, you got to apply it the day after and iterate. And I think that being said, there is active learning and learning strategies. Because nobody teaches you how to learn. And this is a flaw, not only in Moroccan education system, it's worldwide. It's pretty known nowadays. Yep. Like, and especially learning technology is hard. Huh? It's not simple. It's not like watching or like, I mean, I reflect on my college days where you sit down and learn Java EE and the teacher is basically showing you slides with the Java doc. And I'm like, bro, like, what am I looking at here? Like, you know, that's how you learn tech. And nobody will teach you how to learn tech unless you kind of struggle, find your mentor, be actively involved, find your strategy, you know, like not just, if you want to learn TypeScript, if you want to learn a framework or a language, well, find a strategy, you know, like go on and say, this is my goals and I'm going to dedicate time. I'm going to push code to GitHub every day. I'm going to try to do this. And that's what like learning strategies are really important. Like most of the engineers, sadly, they end up in a position and, you know, they work with the same stack all over. They wait for the day, probably they're going to become senior or whatever. And that's it for them. Learning stopped. And that's a mistake. Like it shouldn't.
Yeah,
it shouldn't.
That's definitely. Yeah.
If you think in tech, then you're probably not really fit for a director or like a VP or something like that.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, speaking of learning, like one of the I mean, it kind of sometimes comes down to small things. Like, for example, early on when I was learning different topics like iOS, Objective-C, all of these things, one of the tricks that I kind of, you know, figured out, and probably it's a very small trick, but it kind of was super helpful, is kind of how to find good books, you know, in each topic, right? Like, let's say you want to learn iOS tomorrow. How do you find a good book to read about iOS? Because if you don't know how to do that, you're going to probably waste a lot of time just kind of reading through like useless books or hard books, right? Because you can, if you're getting into the field and you're doing it for the first time, you're going to find yourself reading hard books. And then you're going to be like, apparently this thing is really hard. I'm probably going to drop learning iOS just because I picked up the wrong book, right? And so it's very important to know how to select books you're going to read, how to sort of design your syllabus, as they say in college, right? Like, you need to know how to, okay, this is the first book I'm going to read. This is the second book. And once I'm kind of know what's going on, maybe I'm going to go to this, to the documentation, or read this course or whatever, right? But yeah. I 100% agree on strategies of learning and knowing the I would say the tips and tricks there, and building these this tool set is possibly the most important skill to have, possibly more important than the technical skills themselves, right? Because at the end of the day, what makes a great engineer and a good engineer and an okay engineer, it's probably these things. It's not how many hours you spend coding, but probably how do you kind of navigate the whole maze to get to the top, for
yeah,
sure.
I do interviews every day, and I could tell you what's a great engineer, what's an okay engineer. Not on a resume or like show me your code, none beyond that.
Nice. What would be then the third skill? So you mentioned active learning, you mentioned...
So I missed the first one.
Analytical thinking.
Analytical thinking and innovation. And I think that's first one. Second one is active learning and learning strategy. Third one, I would say, is complex problem solving and critical thinking. Critical thinking is different from analytical thinking. Critical thinking is the edge cases. How can you break something? And you need to have... You need to have that hacker mindset, you know, like, okay, but this solution seems good, but like, nah, think about this. And you want to have that. And that also comes along with complex problem solving. And for this, I'm very thankful to competitive programming. I spent a lot of years just, you know, solving algorithmic problems with C++ and Java sometimes. You know, and that gives you a sense of like, how to think, you know, algorithmic, you know, because basically that's what you do every day. It's with humans, with everything, you know, like you evaluate your input, you evaluate your output. What's the best way I could achieve this? Because it might seem like we don't do happy coding all the time. Like, it's not like that. Like, it's not like school projects. It's very complex. Sometimes you have some dependencies that are just like that. They are there, like a little piece of rock in the middle, and you just can't break out of it. It becomes a constraint. So you have to be able to solve given constraints, and you have inputs, you need to achieve some outputs, and you have some constraints. That constraints could be legacy code, could be some unrealistic feature that requires some whole different way of thinking, could be some scalability issue, could be some opening up to a new market. And you need to be able to solve that problem. Like, say you build something for Sweden, right? And you want to scale it to Germany,
right?
And not scaling the product, but the technology behind it. You have to think like for example, in Sweden, we have like a login feature where you log in with bank ID, which is a digital signature. So you don't need a password in Sweden, basically. You log in with your, like, you have a digital identity. But then you can't take that to Germany. So you have to think, how am I going to build a login with email and password within that one? So do I want to separate, have and start have an identity management thingy where I can aggregate all type of logins? And, you know, and it becomes very complex easily because you have some legacy, you have some code that is running already on production.
Right.
You want to bring new users. And if you can't solve complex problem, forget about flattening up a list and showing cards, you know? Sending an API data and doing something like that.
Yeah.
Especially when you have one feature that goes across, I don't know, like 5, 6 touch points. You know, you have the first client that comes in, then there is like a little API aggregation. Then it goes all the way to like you have a data lake where you have to kind of throw in everything. Then you have a stream behind it that kind of makes sense out of that data. Then it circles back. You need to be able to be a good problem solver. So get down, get a piece of paper and a pen. And there is no code in that. I would say it right here. You have to kind of solve it. How would you solve it if you don't have a computer? And I think best way to learn this is competitive programming.
Right.
Just work with different algorithms. Like there's graph algorithms, they're really nice. Like all state management libraries, they're built on trees. If you look at all garbage collectors, memory stuff, they're built on heaps and stuff like that. And those are data structures, you know? Right. If you work with them and you solve like day-to-day problems, because there's competitive programming problems that are mostly about like, well, we are in a cafe and we want to optimize the number of seats and number of coffee and stuff like this. So you kind of try to modelize the problem, think about like a really nice data structure that would just help you solve the whole thing and then implement it. And that you could see it's basically in every framework. So you do this kind of stuff. There is now graph databases, there is document-based databases that are based on this kind of algorithms. And if you know your stuff, you know how to solve problems, then for you, this kind of stuff, it will, for me, like it takes me probably 1 week to master GraphQL. But if somebody that really doesn't understand the data science, the data structure behind it, the algorithm, the problem solving, you're going to slow down. You're going to, first of all, get a practical way. You just consume GraphQL. If you have a bug, then you're screwed. You have to Stack Overflow. But if you know what you're doing, you could problem solve. And I think you could use it in different things. You could use it in system architecture. You could use it in debugging. You could use it even in basically coming up with features and how you want to solve a user problem, something like that. So I'd say that's top three.
What about management skills? And I guess there was a question about is a degree in management useful, or is it any kind of education, like getting an MBA or any of that useful? Do you see it as required? I probably know what you're gonna say, but I would love to hear it.
That was actually number four on my list, I would say. Number four on the list is leadership and social influence.
Right.
And man, you don't need education to social influence. You just need to be a good talker.
Right.
You know what you're doing. I think there's one amazing book, which is very cliche, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's like the OG book. Like social interactions and social.
It's a very old book. Yeah.
It's a very old book. Like it's like all those communication and charisma and whatever public speaking books, they're all based on that one. I see it as like the OG one. And I think it was written in the 40s or something like that. And I actually have it on my shelf. And I read it a long time ago, not when I was a director. I read it to kind of be good at what I do. Because you have to convince people. If you have a cool idea, you have to convince people so you could actually make it happen. And for me, like leadership came in from early stage. Like back at university, I was involved in activities. And I love to lead. Like if there is a position where I could see there's leadership, I just jump on it and want to solve problems with big squads. And I love that. You know, I mean, I enjoyed solving problems alone, but it's boring. But when you solve problems,
it gets slowly,
it's very euphoric. It gets very fun. And I think I feed on that. So one of the conferences, first conference I attended in Sweden, it's a Java-based conference. And the keynotes, the opening keynote was mind-blowing. I would never forget it. They brought in this guy, CTO of a company in Canada. They do data stuff. And he spoke about leadership. Mm-hmm. And he just changed the concept of leadership for me. Leadership is not bossing people around. Most of the people, they have that conception. It's like, leadership, you have to kind of tell people to do their job or like make sure people are doing what they have to do. He spoke about leadership from within. And it comes from ownership, confidence. You have to own what you're working on. You have to be confident in what you do. You have to continue learning so you can harvest nice confidence. You have to speak and say what you're doing. So basically, if you are an individual contributor, like a junior engineer, you could be a great leader by just speaking out. Every day in the stand-up, for example, you show that you lead what you're doing. You don't have to lead people. You could lead your own job. You could lead your own career. You could lead your own self. And that's when it starts. You have to harvest that. And then when it comes to leading people, yes, you need some social influence, right? Sometimes you have to make rough decisions and you have to communicate that to the people without sounding mean or rough or like that really asshole boss or something like that. You have to kind of make the people understand what are we doing. You have to be able to manage conflict between engineers. You have to not care only about work, but also speak with people about their personal feelings, how they are they happy at their job, are they developing and stuff like that. So you have to have that sense of empathy. And if you've spent hours on cave mode, like just coding, that would be a bit tricky to kind of just have that patience to speak with somebody. And like you could see people developing and stuff like that. It takes some, you need to have some empathy and you need to be not to technology, but at the same time, you know, you have to take care of your people.
Yeah, definitely. Empathy helps a lot. Like being able to see the world from other people's point of view. You know, if you're able to do that, if you're able to look at someone and kind of try at least to see the world from their point of view, makes a lot of things easier because you're going to understand why they're having a bad day, why they're frustrated, and you're going to be probably better at kind of like communicating and, you know, understanding and getting to them sort of the message. Do you think like leadership, is it something you learn? Is it something you kind of are born with? Is it a mix of two? Like what's your stance on that?
Well, I would say it's, I tend to be on the side that of people that thinks that you're not born with stuff. You basically harvest and kind of work on anything that you want. And I think leadership is definitely something you could learn. And I definitely learned leadership. I was not born with it. Biggest kudos for that was that keynote talk that I listened to. Kind of the guy literally taught me how to be a leader. And it's pretty simple. You start with yourself. Be a good leader of yourself. Like you don't want to, and leaders are like basically influencers. And you should just, that's anything with leadership is basically, before tech leadership, leadership in general, like in an abstract form, like if you want to look at it from a philosophical perspective, is basically being an exemplary person. And not like how we see it as like somebody with a whip and like, you know, like that. It's more about like a culture of influencing, bringing people together for one cause. So it is like, you could definitely learn this kind of things. You could harvest your empathy by being more tolerant, being more communicative to people. You could be leader of your craft, as in basically every day when you write code, you write in a leadership style. You want to write code that people want to read and learn something from it. If you want to tell people to write tests, then you don't go around and tell people, hey, what is the test? No, you write tests yourself. When you open a pull request, people will understand, oh, that's a leader, you know?
Yep.
People would follow, and that's how you get there. And I think it's not like I am a leader. What is that book? Management 101. And I think leadership is basically learned by getting around with your people. There is different types of style of leading, but I would say if you trust based on transparency, you'd go really far in that, and you'd learn. I learn every day, basically. Like I tell people, we do have one-on-ones with the engineers and with the managers and designers. And basically during those one-on-ones, I tell people like, how can I be better? And then that's it. You know, you keep learning to become a leader. You say, you apologize when you don't deliver on what you said, or if you promised someone something. You tell people the mistakes that you do and tell them that you're going to get better and stuff like this. You try to get better and all this kind of stuff. So it's definitely something you could learn, I would say.
Yeah. And I guess like the best way to learn it, as you said, it's kind of like you start doing it. Obviously, reading helps a lot. You start doing it, and then kind of you iterate, and you keep improving. And it's definitely something that you could start doing even though you're not even in a leadership position, right? Even though like maybe you just joined the team, you're like a mid-level senior engineer, doesn't mean that you can't be sort of a leader within the group. And as you said, leading by example is probably the best way of leadership. You don't have to wait for someone to give you the mic, like, hey, you're the leader now, go tell people what to do, because probably that's not even what the job description is anyways. But definitely like bring in, for example, best practices to the team and saying, okay, I read this book about, or this blog post about pull requests and best practices around pull requests. I'm going to start practicing in the team, and I'm going to try to convince other people in the team to do the same, right? Write good commits, messages, or I don't know, like doing Git flow, all of these things. Just by doing it yourself, explaining to others why it's worthwhile, how to do it, all of the, you know, doing all the effort in that, probably that's kind of how leader is born in a way, right? Especially in an engineering organization, for sure. Any other skills that you think are must have besides the one we already talked about?
Well, so if you reflect on what we talked about right now, I haven't even mentioned technology yet. And I think, and I've seen tech leaders actually with no tech background. They're basically, especially people in Silicon Valley, most of the tech leads or the tech leader, directors, CTOs, they're not really good engineers. They can't write code. You know, you'd cry if you see their code. I mean, I wouldn't want it to anybody. But this kind of skills, the first skills that we spoke about, makes you handle high-level thinking. You could actually speak with engineers. Like, you need those kind of skills, and you need good engineers. They could achieve great stuff. So that's why, for me, technology comes fifth. And technology, not in terms of programming and design, first, technology use. Most of the companies, they lose a lot of money because they're not using the proper technology to just self-manage the whole company.
Right.
Like companies use recruitment. I see people, they're still struggling with recruiting people just because they are not willing to pay a platform that will help you do this kind of stuff. And they're like, why would I pay it? Well, you don't understand why this company exists. You know, they help you solve this and this and that. Like companies that use, for example, tools that are very outdated. Like companies that kind of, if you are developing on a, I don't know, like for example, you're using, I would say JavaScript stuff or like mainly like iOS and things like that. And then you're forcing your people to use Windows environments and stuff like that.
Right.
You're doing it wrong. And like the toolings, for example, if you don't really understand the power of Git, and I know some companies in Sweden are still using SVN. shit, man. Like when I hear about this stuff, I'm like, what, are we in the 90s or something?
Yeah. You know,
and how some companies, they just not like documentation. I mean, I praise companies that use Notion these days.
Right.
You know, to kind of aggregate documentation, to communicate like beautiful communication. And, you know, and there is that kind of thing. So technology use is kind of critical here.
Yeah, yeah.
With the processes, basically. Helps
yeah, which project management tool you use, which...
this kind of things. Yeah, which
version control system.
Or Gmail and all these kind of things. You have to understand the technology because it's an enabler, after all. Before you create technology, technology is there to enable you to create more technology. So you got to use it wide, and you have to understand it. Some companies, they use Salesforce, but then they don't really understand what they're doing. They just pay in a lot of cash because, well, it's a CRM and I could sell, you know?
Right.
But wait, did you know that Salesforce is a whole system that could help you actually integrate within your whole platform and things like that? And you need to bring in that to the table, especially for a director position. You need to make that bridge because you're not only building products, you're kind of directing the technology in general, and you need to make sure the whole company is using technology properly to do the day-to-day work, to produce product, and to manage the relationship between customers and all of that. So technology use for me comes first than technology design and programming. And that for me, I bring it like after, which is now that you got all of this, you're basically a mastermind, you're a maestro, you know the technology, you know how to spend money to use technology, you know how you could basically hack your way through while using technology and growth hack and all this kind of stuff. Then comes the part where you build. where sometimes a lot of that gets covered from the engineers, basically. So you don't really have to code. If you're good at communicating, you're good at critical thinking and analytical thinking, you bring the engineers and you have open forums. This is what we need to do, guys, and then, or girls. And then you kind of discuss, how are we going to do it? And then they can help you, actually. You know, sometimes they teach me a lot of stuff, like, you know, like, oh, how does all this document-based database work? I come from an SQL background. Then you sit down with them and you learn something new. So the active learning comes in place.
Yep.
And then you have the analytical thinking. Then you compare. Oh, so it's just like JSON somewhere in memory. And then you start, you know, then technology basically just fits in there. When you got all of those unlocked, you become that proper director. When you sit in a design conversation, you understand what everybody's saying and you bring in that element of orchestrating. When you sit down with designers, you've done your problem thinking and all of that, and you know what kind of edge cases you be careful of, so you communicate that properly to the designers to think about them. When you do, for example, when you manage stakeholders and backlog, you know, you have that leadership skill. You know, you tell them, yeah, the people that we have, this is what they can do. We need more people and this kind of stuff. So you kind of that leader that can speak up. So, and technology here kind of come in to complete. So you could understand what the teams are doing. You could evaluate, because you don't find yourself contributing that much. I mean, you contribute when shit goes down. Sometimes you have to pull up sleeves and be like, okay, all right, give me that branch. You open your PR. I've done that.
And yeah, I was gonna ask about, like, do you still get time to write code? Are you able to, you know?
Most of the time I do prototyping. I don't develop the code end to end properly, but I kind of prove ideas. I have somebody give me a branch where I can give me like a staging link or like a staging environment where I can deploy my stuff. So I kind of like try to, when I do problem solving and stuff like that, I try to have like a proof of concept and try to see if it's gonna sell or not. Currently we're working with a partner that is interested in selling energy through us. So we became that energy as a service, so people can sell energy through us. And for me, I was not sure how the offering is going to be. Should we just build APIs that they can use, or should we use admin portal as well, where they can see graphs and KPIs? So I was not particularly sure. So I had to build that something, an MVP, play with it and present it to the partner, kind of a sales engineering.
Yeah.
This is what we can build. I built this in, but with the right investment and team behind it, not me with my shitty code. great. You find yourself doing that. And sometimes there is like a bug in production and senior people are already on something and then junior people are stuck. You kind of want to, you know, be nice and sit down with them, do some debugging. And even though you don't understand, like, you're not necessarily master of what you're doing, like with React Native stuff. But then I sit down with them and I go like, what does that mean? Ah, so you're using this client to do this. Then you make sense and you just solve it, basically.
Yeah, being fast learner helps a lot in these kind of roles where you're going to be involved in different technologies, different scopes. You're going to be talking to product people, product managers. You're going to be talking to maybe at some point sales, all of that. Being a fast learner helps you at least sort of understand sort of what are they saying? What do I have to say? And kind of, you know, get up to speed very quickly. So, yeah, definitely. So that's kind of number, I think, 5, right?
That was number 6. Number 5 is technology use.
Right.
Number 6 is technology design and programming. And I think I have the last one, which is number 7.
Right.
Which is resilience and stress tolerance.
Okay.
I mean, I'm getting all better, man, with this. it's not easy. It's not easy at all.
Yeah, definitely.
Extremely flexible. You have to have some mental resilience. You know, sometimes there's a lot of politics and, you know, it's money, you know, it's like big, big assets. And, you know, it's like a big, small mistakes could crash the whole thing, especially if your core business is technology. So you don't want to mess up with that. You know, you want to make sure the interns are not pushing code to production. You want to make sure there is a on-call rotation. There is always plans to break out. You want to keep an eye on security stuff, GDPR, budgeting, staffing. You know, it's a tough situation. And you think about a lot of things at the same time. You do a lot of switching, like multi-processing. Sometimes you think about technology, sometimes people, sometimes budget, sometimes risk assessment. Sometimes you want to make sure you're not leaking data or whatever. And it takes some mental capacity.
100%.
It's not a day-to-day. You show up, you check your backlog, and you code a little bit, you take a coffee. It's not like that. It's really stressful. And it is like that, for an engineering manager, it would be like that stress divided by five or number of teams that director has.
Right.
When shit goes down, first person, like, you don't go to the engineers. Engineers, they make mistakes. You go to the director and be like, what the fuck? When projects fall behind, when things like that happen, it's basically comes up to the director. I mean, you're in direct conversation with the engineering manager, but they can't do that much. So you have to take that responsibility and that accountability. And it comes with you don't have to kind of sacrifice that stress for the technology choices. You still want to keep a healthy culture. You still want people to write tests. You still want people to have continuous delivery. You still want people to document. But at the same time, you want to deliver and deliver properly and deliver products that fits in the market and all of that. So you need definitely some mental resilience. You can't be like, oh man, I'm tired of this. let me code a little bit and let me do some CSS or stuff like that. You're in it. That's it.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's the thing about management, is that the more decision making you're going to do, the more accountability you're going to have also with that, right? So it's not only, okay, I'm going to, make more decisions. Yes, probably. But then you're going to also have to be more, accountable to over more things, right? And is what also you mentioned, when a bug happens, even though you weren't the one who caused the bug necessarily, it kind of, you're probably the person to blame at the end of the day, and you gotta take that.
The C level, I only see one director. It's like, why is the app not working? I'm like, bro, chill. Gotta fire me.
Right. Yeah. And I guess you're also doing a lot of hiring, a lot of interviews, things like that. Is that a big percentage of what we do, or kind of like?
I work with some recruitment agencies, but I like to take care of that myself. I don't want to work with anybody, especially as you said, if you have like a stressful thingy and you know that you have some expectations, you want to be overlooking that recruitment, especially you want to kind of pick up the people that would fit in your culture, and at the same time, people that would help you lift up a lot of kind of responsibilities and kind of lead and all of this. So I do most of the interviews myself, but our interview process is kind of broad. We do at least four interviews, different levels. Like we have like a architecture interview where you basically sit with one architect and one senior engineer, and they give you a problem. They see how you're going to architect that from either a front-end thing when you have like a client, and they're going to see how you're going to work out with your server. How can you mock a server if the server is not there? You're working on a new feature. How are you gonna work with not only architecture? Sometimes it gets into operation as well, like DevOps stuff. I think there is an uprising trend here in Stockholm. At least you don't find DevOps people. It's like an engineer, and you're supposed to write code, build it, ship it, monitor. Right. You're responsible for the whole thing. So makes sense. Do a bit of those exercises as well. Just to make sure that people understand what it means to ship code, like when what does happen between your repo, the code base, and the user using the products or the API being hit by requests. So what is that gap between? How do you deliver your code? And we try, and that's really important these days. If you don't understand that, it probably you gotta catch a train quick. Otherwise,
That's actually what full stack used to mean initially. Like full stack before it was back end, front end. Full stack meant like you're a back end, but you're like full stack back end, right? Like you're writing the code, you're shipping, you're testing it, you're building the deployment pipelines, you're deploying it, maintaining the servers, all of that. I guess nowadays it's just called back end engineer, but I definitely like that kind of
And engineers, like for example in Sweden and all the Nordic countries, not somebody with a master's degree or from an engineering school. Because I mean, they have engineering schools here in Sweden, like they have KTH and stuff like technical schools, but they don't call them engineering schools. Like it's a curriculum is pretty simple, 5 years for everybody, you get a master's. But what I mean, like Like I see people that are 19 years old and they are engineers. That's because right. they build code and ship it and monitor it.
Right.
They know how to do that. They learned it in high school and that's it. You're basically an engineer. Nice. You go to Google or Klarna or Spotify. You have an engineer position. Basically 60% of them, they don't have a degree. People that can actually write code and ship it. That's it.
Okay, so no bachelor, nothing.
Ah, man, forget about those days. They're gone. Rising kids these days. Like, I hired a lot of people, and we don't even check this education part. It's like, talk to me. What's up? Somebody
yeah, yeah.
what you're talking about that. That's it. You could tell who's an engineer and who's not.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's same for us too. Demography, we do. I mean, yeah, it's the same thing. Like, we don't look at degrees. We had some really awesome front-end developers who didn't even have a high school degree, right? Like, no high school degree. We didn't care. And no bachelor, no master degree, same thing. And I guess also for compensation, it's also to kind of like unify compensation based on skills, not degrees. Because, like, I guess a lot of companies here in Morocco, at least, like, they still do compensation based on degrees, right? Like, you know, if you have a master's degree, you're going to get more money if you have a bachelor. Sometimes even for the same kind of level of skills, right? Yeah. But yeah,
I think that's a flaw in the educational system, and it's heavily influenced from the French one. And it's not top notch. I mean, the French education
100%
is not an exemplary one. And it's like they kind of calculate merit based on the degree, which is, if it's in a capitalist world where you have to pay taxes, so
right.
you say, well, if you study, we invested 5 years in teaching you something, then you probably should earn this amount of money, because after all, they're going to get more taxes from you.
Right.
That's how it works. So it's like educational system mixed with how the economical background is, and then that's it, you know? And it doesn't encourage creativity. They build, and usually if you fall into that system, you think of yourself highly, but actually you're not. So, I mean, I come from that system and I understood it the hard way, in a way that it's like, what I went 5 years for a degree. And then now, like, you know, I see people, they have 19 and they're basically earning same right. entry because that person invested in a craftsmanship or craftswomanship. It's a craft, and yeah, school can teach you to become an employee, but in order to learn the craft, you have to, you know, get a mentor. Like I was saying, there is a hefa. You know, you can't.
Right. Yeah.
You don't teach like that type of skills in school, and you know, it's more because tech as well. It's you're either a tech employee, you know, you just write code, or like you're a tech entrepreneur. You know, you write code that you understand what's going on, even though you're working for companies. Like the entrepreneur yep. doesn't mean necessarily I have my own company. I'm hustling. You know, mm-hmm. like if you have that entrepreneur mindset and you write code, or you could write software, it's a collaboration. You never stick to one company. You work with company, you build something great for them, you move on. Right. And in Sweden, there is a big trend of self-consultants. You know, yeah, mm-hmm. you want to call it freelancer, but they even have it. Consultant. They start their own company. Like the government right. has made it easy for people to start that. And basically, they invoice people. I work with big right. company, and I invoice you per hour because I build software, man. You want it or not? And there, it's the model that works. I have like two consultants now, and they are self-employed. Like they write code, and they're not interested in being in a company. They just want to write code and move on to the next projects and so on. So yeah, education and stuff like that. It depends what you really want. If you see coding or like software as a job, that's one thing. If you see it as a career, that's another thing. But if you see it as a purpose or like as a, you know, as a way of living, you know, that you're that techie person, you're a tech advocate, then it's completely different. Like, it doesn't matter if you have a degree or not.
100%. My last question would be, what's next for you as a director of engineering? Like, what's sort of like the next step when you're director of engineering?
I think next step is not like a ladder to look at, but mostly right. step is to build something great. I think that's the pride you could get as a director. So you build like a legacy. You don't build the app and as an individual contributor, but you solve a big problem that exists. That's what I'm really most excited about. And that's what made me make the move actually into a position like this and take that trade off. As I said, it's really stressful. you know, it sucks up a lot of my time. Basically, I had a lot of fun activities. Like this year, I barely skydived. I used to skydive like crazy, like 200 jumps a year and all of that. But this year, be quite not okay. That much. I got very much invested in this. But then for me, next step is to build something great, you know? And for me, I feel very lucky. Alhamdulillah, Hitesh. I feel like it became a purpose. First, when I graduated, I was like, cool, I'm going to get my dream job as an engineer. Going to code, you know, like coding as your hobby and all that.
Yeah. Cool.
Which is not true. Then it becomes, okay, this is, I went beyond the job mindset and it became a career where I started climbing quickly. And I was like, nah, I'm not happy with this. I want to become better. Then a point of my career, I realized, well, okay, you're a director now. And basically, you know, what's next? Like, there isn't much. So it becomes a purpose. So I started using technology in a very I started seeing technology in a really complete way. Like you become that technology advocacy. So I do teach a lot of programming in the Stockholm community, like for kids, for people that want to switch career. I want to build great technology that enables people. That's why this project that I'm working on with Energy is very exciting. I'm really looking forward to have a mature platform. We just starting. We're not really, I mean, yeah, we're the fastest growing company in Sweden, but we're actually just starting. We haven't started yet. We're just warming up. And we really want to, and I really want to build the technology behind that. I've seen the technology behind streaming. I worked with WebRTC back in the days. I've seen the technology behind fintech, how finance and technology combines and do great things. You know, I haven't seen yet some technology that enables something very, you know, like energy and in a green way and sustainable and all that. So it's really interesting times ahead. And I'm really looking forward to the technology we're going to build.
100%. And looking forward to having Svea Solar sometimes in, you know, Morocco. We'd love to have that clean tech energy here. Good luck to you and good luck to Svea Solar and to you particularly and everything you're building. You know, wish you the best of luck. And as I, you know, would love to, I mean, Morocco is great is a great country when it comes to solar energy, at least has a lot of potential. And I hope there is like a lot of investment there, and definitely having more tech companies around that sector is going to help that. But thank you very much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure that sort of everyone who was with us today hopefully liked it. We've kind of run out of time, probably have like a ton more questions, but hopefully for next time we can discuss some of those. Culture, hiring, you know, you mentioned something about being a good versus okay versus, you know, bad engineer and kind of the difference there. So a lot of topics to explore, and hopefully we'll get the chance to kind of get to those also at some point. But I learned a ton of things today. So thank you very much for that. And, you know, enjoy the rest of the week and cheers. And of course, thank you. And obviously to everyone who was watching us or kind of stayed till now, thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you very much for tuning into this first episode of DevRev season 2, of course. We're going to be coming back with another episode next week, of course. So it's going to be probably about job hunting and sort of tips and tricks there, and sort of for the folks who are looking for internships, what do you need to know? And also for the folks who are looking for full-time jobs, sort of what are kind of the tips and tricks there. So we'll have two special guests, amazing guests for next week. And until then, take care of yourself. Cheers. Bye. Zaki.
Bye.
Thank you. Cheers.